time.
Thank you so much, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. When I was last here on February 5th, we asked you to reverse a one-page order of the Chancery Court, and that still is the procedural posture of the case. We're still the appellant, although, as the Court knows, everything has changed. And in this unusual argument, the appellant will urge upon you the sensible rationale of the Chancery Court, and I rather suspect my colleague will urge the opposite. To that end, I thought I could perhaps do the most service by rebuttal, and so I asked for 10 minutes of rebuttal time, and if it's possible, that's what I will use. There's a particular irony about this unusual posture, which is that if Vice Chancellor Laster's report were the actual order, then it wouldn't even be appealable, at least not as of right. And so my colleagues urge you to overcome the judgment of a trial judge who says the case ought to proceed before me. To do that, they've launched a fairly provocative attack upon the report that you directed the Vice Chancellor to carry out. They've said that he's unfaithful to the application of New York law, indeed that Vice Chancellor Laster engaged in a wholesale reinterpretation, is what the brief says. But in fact, when you look at the report and when you look at the cases he's discussing, he's been entirely faithful, both to the tasking that he received here and to the cases themselves. His report proceeds in a deductive way from a general rule that applies to integrated agreements like this, which is that you look for the ordinary meaning of the words, to the often cited rule that no action clauses are applied narrowly. And then he hasn't just quoted cases, he's proved that point with a century of jurisprudence from the New York State courts, all of which line up around the proposition that the courts will draw a distinction between the security, or the note, or the bond, on the one hand, and the indenture on the other, and will not presume that there is a bar against rights asserted in the name of the bondholder unless the no-action clause says that, in plain words. In fact, one of the many ironies of this case now is that you directed the Vice Chancellor to explore New York law on this point, and he did. And if you were to look just at the New York State cases that he has cited and that the parties have cited, there isn't one, not a single one, in which a bondholder was barred from bringing a non-contractual claim by a no-action clause that referred only to the indenture.
Mr. Willett, no matter which way we were to resolve the current appeal, it would amount to our making our best guess as to how the New York courts would decide the issue. The question is, why shouldn't we certify this issue to the New York Court of Appeals?
Because, Your Honor, there's no law in New York that would support the proposition that my colleagues advance, and there is law.
Well, respond that that's at the very least debatable.
Well, Your Honor, I think they rest almost entirely on these a couple of recent trial court level cases from New York. Walnut Place is one of them. Emmett is another. Greenwich Financial a third. And they're all the same. They're all cases in which the plaintiff is bringing a claim for breach of contract, and the contract itself, whether it's a PSA or an indenture, has a no-action clause that bars that very thing. That's all that those cases stand for, whereas the older cases that Vice Chancellor Laster cited stand for the opposite rule, which is that you don't bar a claim asserted by the bondholder unless there's a specific bar in the clause.
All of that, you know, is very plausible, maybe right, but how can we eliminate the possibility that if this issue were before the New York Court of Appeals, it would say, Delaware, you got it wrong?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that there are many cases in which the Delaware courts are asked to interpret some provision of New York law. Many agreements invoke New York law, and if we certified every question in which a skillful litigant tries to generate a dispute, we'd never be able to advance. I mean, we're almost two years.
Did the Second Circuit cases predict how the highest court of New York, the Court of Appeals, would rule on these issues?
At least they did implicitly, Your Honor, in Cruden, for example, in which, and in Victor versus Rickless is not the Second Circuit, but in Cruden, the court held that a no-action clause like ours did not reach non-contractual claims. Let me restate, it's not the holding of Cruden, but Cruden, the Second Circuit sent the case back to the district court because it disagreed, I think, with a statute of limitations ruling, but allowed that case to proceed on the non-contractual claims when they had a no-action clause just like ours. And then Judge Free in Victor versus Rickless noted the difference. He had a clause like the one in Feldbaum and like the one in Lange, neither of which, by the way, certified a question to the New York State courts. The vice chancellor construed the agreement as he thought made sense. You know, part of this trip that we've taken back to the New York courts has illustrated sort of where we started, which is that both in New York and in Delaware, before a court will take away a remedy that a party has that the legislature has given the party, for example, under DUFTA, you need specific words that they've agreed to, and they don't exist in this contract, those words.
Well, can we get back to the theme, I think, of one of Justice Jacobs' questions? Would this case qualify for acceptance of a certification by the New York Court of Appeals under that court's rules?
Your Honor, I should confess I don't have that rule in mind at the moment. I don't think that there's a serious question raised, and so I think you would certainly be within your discretion to not certify the question, just because you would have so many questions of New York law certified were you to certify this one. There's nothing in New York law to support the position that they've taken. In fact, one of many ironies here is that while Vice Chancellor Laster is criticized for not following this Walnut Place case, in fact, he did follow it to our detriment, because he has recommended that you affirm his dismissal as to counts 7 and 8, which he deems to proceed from the indenture, and under the rule of Walnut Hill, a contractual claim would be barred. Walnut Place, excuse me. So he's been faithful to that case in deciding that our opponents should prevail on a little bit less than half the loaf here. I should talk for a moment about Tang. I know that there's tension between the Vice Chancellor's ruling and the ruling in Tang, although I'm not sure whether the Tang appeal in this court is now moot in light of the Chapter 11 filing. I would rather suspect any request for a receiver would now be moot in light of that request. But as far as we can tell, the Tang case suffers from the same infirmity that the Vice Chancellor identified here. They had to rewrite the language, the Vice Chancellor did, in order to come up with that reading of the no-action clause. In fact, as Chancellor Walcott said in resolving two receivership cases in the 30s in different ways, it's just a function of the wording of the clauses in the contract. Your Honors, I wonder if I should cede the podium unless there are more questions now, and then come back in rebuttal to the points that my colleague might make.
Very well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Nicholas Joseph for all defendant appellees.
Mr. Joseph, in the interest of even-handedness, I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked opposing counsel about certification.
One point on which Quadrant and defendants agree, apparently, is that certification isn't necessary in this case. And the reason that we believe it's not necessary is that the distinction that Quadrant has attempted to impose on no-action clauses. That is a distinction between no-action clauses that use the word securities, or the equivalent, and no-action clauses that don't, has never been relied on, made, or even mentioned by a New York state court.
So your answer is the same as Mr. Willett's, that there's no real issue here, no serious issue?
We think not, and the reason is that the entire basis of this appeal is that single attempt to distinguish between no-action clauses that way. And the only cases that make that distinction are two federal district court cases, Cruden and Victor. No New York state cases do that. In fact, I would submit that it's safe to say that if Cruden and Victor didn't exist, we wouldn't be here today. And the question then becomes, would a New York state court follow the federal district court decisions in Cruden and Victor? And the answer to that question, based on not just Walnut Place, Greenwich, and Emmett, but also earlier New York state cases, is no.
Well, how do we know that?
Okay. So first, let's take a look at Cruden and Victor. First, they're federal district court decisions, so a New York state court is going to follow them only if they're well-reasoned and persuasive. And neither of them is. In Cruden, the federal district court doesn't cite a single New York case in its interpretation of the no-action clause, and in fact cites nothing at all. It's a single sentence. Now, Mr. Willett said that the Second Circuit in Cruden implicitly affirmed the district court's decision that the no-action clause didn't apply. But that's not true. The only issue on which the Second Circuit passed with respect to the no-action clause was whether it applied to claims against the trustee. And the court held that it did not, applying a longstanding exception for claims that are based on trustee misconduct, that no demand is necessary if the trustee is accused of misconduct. There's no other statement about the no-action clause by the Second Circuit in Cruden, and all the Second Circuit did was remand for further proceedings consistent with its opinion. So it's equally plausible that none of the parties actually raised this issue to the Second Circuit. So Cruden is only a federal district court decision, not a Second Circuit decision, and entirely untethered to any citation of New York state law.
So there's no prediction of how the New York Court of Appeals would have ruled on the issues involved in this case?
Not in either the district court or the Second Circuit opinion in Cruden. That's correct, Your Honor. Victor makes a distinction between the no-action clause before it, which it held barred claims that weren't based on a breach of the indenture, and the no-action clause that had been before the district court in Cruden. But it's just a statement in dicta, also without support. Its only support is the district court's decision in Cruden. So the analysis is completely untethered, not just to New York State or Second Circuit authority, but really to any argumentation whatsoever. So let's look instead at the recent cases of the New York Supreme Court and the appellate division. The distinction doesn't appear there either. In fact, the cases are inconsistent with such a decision, with such a distinction, because in Walnut Place, the New York Supreme Court endorsed Feldbaum explicitly. It quoted Feldbaum and endorsed it, even though the no-action clause that the Walnut Place court was considering did not include the word securities. Now, Quadrant has said, well, it's possible that the court would have come to a different conclusion had the facts been different, but that's simply speculation. All we have is an explicit endorsement of Feldbaum in Walnut Place. It requires speculation based on a distinction that doesn't appear in any of the New York State cases to argue that a New York State court would find this distinction important.
So you're telling us that none of the New York State cases address the distinction, if any there is, between the clauses that use the language or the security and those that don't.
That's correct, Your Honor, but they're inconsistent with that distinction because, for instance...
But there's no explicit address of that issue as far as you read the cases?
There is no explicit discussion of no action clauses that include the word securities and those that don't. That's correct.
So it would be up to us, would it not, to read the through the tea leaves of the various cases to draw whatever inferences should be drawn?
It would be up to this court to apply the law as articulated by New York State courts.
That wasn't my question.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Then I will be more explicit. I don't think they're tea leaves. I believe that the statements that the New York State courts have made are not consistent with this distinction. Walnut Place's statement that if a bondholder sues on behalf of all note holders, that it must comply with the no action clause, with the sole exception being when the trustee is disabled by a conflict, is not consistent with the distinction between no action clauses that use a particular word and no action clauses that don't. In fact, the Walnut Place court...
Well, that's an inference that you would have us draw.
It is an inference, Your Honor.
Right. And the other side argues that they're, from other cases, that they're quite opposite inferences that should be drawn. And yet neither side is willing to concede that there's a serious issue of New York law.
It's not a serious dispute because Quadrant is incorrect as to the inference drawn, inferences it draws to those cases. And I can run through the cases and show that. For instance, Walnut Place, the court, if the distinction between no action clauses that included the word securities and those that didn't was important, the Walnut Place court had at its fingertips the exact case it could have cited for that distinction, and that's Victor. It could have said, we need to address a no-action clause that doesn't include the word securities. What is the coverage of such a no-action clause? There are two federal district court cases that address this exact distinction. Even though those were the very facts before it, the court didn't do that. Instead, it endorsed a broad rule in Feldbaum. And the New York Supreme Court did the same thing in Emmett. At page 851, it said, if a predicate to recover is proving a breach of legal obligations other than those directly addressing the payment of principal and interest, then the no-action clause applies. That's a broad statement when the New York Supreme Court is perfectly capable of making the exact distinction that Quadrant puts forward here. And in addition to Walnut Place's endorsement of Feldbaum, the Emmett Court endorsed the rule in RBC, which is not limited, as Quadrant asserts, to breaches of the indenture. Chancellor Starnes specifically refers to breaches of fiduciary duty when considering actions that injure the trust at page 6 of the opinion. In addition, these three recent cases are consistent with considerably older New York State authority that addresses the coverage of no-action clauses. In the Green case from 1933, the appellate division, considering a no-action clause that included the equivalent of the word securities, put no weight on that in borrowing a statutory receivership claim, as the Vice Chancellor's report concedes at page 40. Instead, the court held that the no-action clause applied because, and I'm quoting it from page 648 of the opinion, the plaintiff, as a bondholder, holds his securities subject to the condition of this underlying trust agreement and can maintain an action only upon the conditions specified in the trust agreement. Again, a broad rule that doesn't distinguish between no action clauses worded one way and no action clauses worded another. Similarly,
what is the most recent New York Court of Appeals case, if any, that provides guidance that would be helpful to us on New York law?
As far as we're aware, there's no New York Court of Appeals case that addresses no action clauses. Had there been such a case, I hope one or the other of us would have found it. However, the New York Court of Appeals does state quite clearly that, and has done so repeatedly as recently as, I believe, 2011 in the Travelers case, that any contract must be interpreted to give meaning to every phrase, every word. And an additional reason why the interpretation that Quadrant has put forward is wrong is that instead of looking to the words in the contract and giving them meaning, Quadrant is attempting to create a broad rule as to all contracts based on whether a specific word is included. It is attempting to synthesize contracts written by different parties. New York State courts don't do that. New York State courts look to the words that the parties actually used and interpret the words that the parties actually used. Here, Quadrant is putting all of its weight on a word that doesn't even appear in the contract. And by virtue of doing that, it ignores the words that do appear in the contract. So, for instance, Quadrant has offered no plausible interpretation of what by virtue or availing of means in the no action clause here. And I say plausible in that the report concedes, as it must, that its own interpretation renders all of those words superfluous. Quadrant put forward a distinction to the Court of Chancery. It didn't make a lot of sense, and the Court of Chancery didn't accept it. That distinction is that one of these phrases, I'm never able to remember which one, applies to rights that are automatic, and another of these phrases applies to rights that are optional. The problem with that distinction, of course, is that all rights are optional. A party has to decide whether to enforce those rights. In addition, Quadrant has never supplied an interpretation of what the part of the no action clause, stating that it applies to any action upon or under or with respect to the indenture, means. That entire phrase could be eliminated under Quadrant's reading. New York State court wouldn't allow that. The parties had a very simple way of expressing in their own words the desire to cover only breaches of the indenture. They would have done that by saying that the no action clause covers any breach of the indenture. The parties would not have relied on courts to look to no action clauses in other situations to make an inference that the failure to use a particular word somehow meant that the parties intended a narrower application than other parties did. In addition, and while this is an old case, it is still a statement of New York law from a New York State court. In Ernst, the New York Supreme Court barred a claim for a statutory receiver to set aside a fraudulent transfer, and the court did not even quote the no action clause, but rather simply characterized it as providing at page 228, no action under the indentures may be maintained unless certain requirements are complied with. And even though, as Quadrant does here, the plaintiffs argued that their claim was not under the indenture, but rather under debtor and creditor law, the court held that their action was barred because, and this is a quote from page 229 of the opinion, the nature of their action shows that they are presuming to speak for all the bondholders and not for themselves alone. They are attempting to protect their rights under the indenture, but to be permitted to do so, they must not contravene its terms.
I want to be sure I understand the thrust of your argument, and it appears to be that although the distinction recognized by the Vice Chancellor in the remand report might be acceptable to federal courts in New York, it's never been recognized by any state court in New York, and therefore it should be clear to us that as a matter of New York state law, he was incorrect, and the report should not be accepted.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I would seek to defend a bit the federal district courts that decided the Cruden and Victor cases. Those courts did not have the benefit of Greenwich, Walnut, or Emmett. Those are cases from, at the earliest, 2010. And I would submit that those cases would have been decided differently had they had the benefit of more recent New York State authority, and on top of that, a much more recent.
And you say that in part and because these more recent cases didn't cite to the federal cases at all, so implicitly rejecting that line of reasoning.
That's correct, Your Honor. Feldbaum, in the nicest possible way, says that the Victor Court was mistaken in distinguishing, in determining how Cruden actually worked. The Chancellor said that the difference wasn't the no-action clause, but for the Second Circuit, the difference was the identity of the defendant. So in citing Feldbaum, the court wasn't simply adopting a broad rule when it could simply have accepted the distinction from the federal district decisions. It was adopting a broad rule that the court itself said was inconsistent with Victor. And the Vice Chancellor in the report here also says quite rightly that the rule in Feldbaum is such that if the trustee is capable of bringing the claim, the no-action clause applies. So because New York state courts have adopted that rule, there isn't much ambiguity, I would submit, in how the courts would consider this case. They would also look to Feldbaum.
But from the Vice Chancellor's perspective, that only meant that two counts were out, not the other counts.
That's right, Your Honor. And in addition to Victor and Reckless, which I've tried to argue are not persuasive, the Court of Chancery relied extensively on cases that were decided prior to the Trust Indenture Act. And these cases actually do not support the distinction that the report imposes on them. In fact, all of these cases deal with the bondholder's right to receive interest and principal. The Trust Indenture Act resolved this question, providing that the right to receive interest and principal could not be restricted. But to the extent that any of these cases is discussing a right on the bonds, it's simply discussing the right to receive interest and principal. You can see this, for instance, in the General Investment Company case. It says at page 909, the action is by the holder of the notes against the maker on the maker's primary obligation to pay the debt, evidenced by said notes.
Is it accurate to say that the recent New York Supreme Court cases upon which you rely, that none of those are pending appeal before the New York Court of Appeals?
Yes, Your Honor. Even with respect to the Pretrust Indenture Act cases, the courts did not use a hard and fast rule about the presence of a particular word to decide the case. Instead, they said each instrument must be interpreted according to its own terms. So in the Friedman case, the court held that all rights of action on this debenture and the annexed interest coupons meant the same thing as any action or proceeding at law or in equity for the collection of principal or interest of said bonds, as the court ruled in the Ruddick case. So even in those cases, the court was not looking for a shibboleth to obtain particular coverage. And on top of that, New York courts do not allow an exception to a no-action clause to swallow the rule, which is what would happen here. In the Emmett case, which I mentioned earlier, a bondholder sued for unpaid interest, which is a classic individual right. But despite the Trust Indenture Act and the presence of the provision in the indenture there entitling the bondholder to sue for interest or principal, the New York Supreme Court held the suit was barred because such suits would interfere with the operation of the no-action clause. The court explained, and this is at pages 860 to 61 of the opinion, allowing suits for unaccrued payment obligations would essentially allow all claims relating to the value of the bond and would let the payment exception swallow the no-action clause. As such, the interest exception must not be construed to render the no-action clause ineffective. The Van Wezel case from 1939 makes exactly the same point at page 96. The court said that the plan to afford the protection of the no-action clause, and now I'm quoting, would be frustrated if a holder of some bonds could, by proceeding on them, bring about a situation injurious to bondholders in general. So the court's broad statements the New York Supreme Court's broad statements all counsel against a mincing interpretation of the no-action clause that would leave Quadrant free to pursue some claims but not others on exactly the same facts.
Mr. Joseph, I may be a little off in terms of my history, but I understand that the New York Bar has been cranking out bond indentures for well over 100 years. Is it the case that the New York Court of Appeals has never had occasion to construe a bond indenture under New York law, or are you telling us that the New York Court of Appeals has never addressed the specific portion of the bond indenture, namely the no-action clause?
We were unable to find one addressing a no-action clause.
But there are cases that address other aspects of the indenture?
I would assume so, although I'm not familiar with any of them offhand.
Is it the case that New York court, that there's a rule of construction in New York that bond indentures will be construed narrowly?
There are statements in federal district court cases that no action clauses should be construed narrowly, but as I've shown in both the Emmett and Van Weasel cases, New York state courts reject that canon of construction where the purpose of the no-action clause would be frustrated. It's also true that Quadrant's reading would disrupt not just New York law, but would also disrupt the law of receivership. I won't run through the cases, but going back as far as 1989, the Delaware Chancery Court has interpreted no-action clauses that are substantively identical to the one here as barring any claim for a receiver, regardless of the source of that claim. And this Quadrant's distinction would throw that into confusion. In addition, Quadrant's reading is inconsistent with the purpose of no-action clauses, which, as the Emmett Court has said, barriers to action by individual bondholders serve an important purpose by both preventing expensive lawsuits that do not have the support of a substantial portion of the creditors while also centralizing the prosecution of lawsuits whose benefits should properly accrue to all bondholders. Quadrant's distinction between claims that are based on a breach of the indenture and claims that are based on some other legal right would completely subvert that purpose by allowing different parties to bring claims based on exactly the same facts without complying with the requirements of the no-action clause.
Well, of course, the solution to that is to draft a no-action clause that's sweeping in its coverage, isn't it?
This no-action clause is sweeping in its coverage. It merely doesn't use a magic word, which New York courts would not require. In addition, the court I've heard concerned about certifying this issue to the New York Court of Appeals, but another reason why that's not necessary is that it is possible to rule narrowly in defendants' favor. It is not possible to rule narrowly in Quadrant's favor because, as I've said, it requires that there be a categorical difference between no-action clauses that include the word securities and no-action clauses that don't. But a ruling in defendants' favor would not even require that this court disagree with Cruden and Victor. This court could hold that the broadening language present in the no-action clause here, coupled with other provisions of the indenture requiring majority consent wherever the rights of all bondholders are affected, not present or not discussed in those cases, and the statement in the private placement memorandum that the no-action clause covers rights under the indenture and the notes, Quadrant's magic words, means that the contracting parties here intended the same coverage as those in Feldbaum and Lang. This leaves for another day and a New York state court the ultimate question of New York law.
Thank you, Mr. Joseph.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I think I have the answer on certification. I had a moment to think about this. There are two reasons why it's unnecessary, at least here. The first none of us has talked about yet, which is the procedural posture of the case. At the moment, the report would essentially be an interlocutory order. It would not represent a final judgment based on all of the extraneous facts, like the one you just heard about the private placement memorandum, about the meaning of this agreement. If we had that private placement memorandum here, actually I think it's B206 of your appendix, you'd see that it explicitly says, we're not sure we're completely consistent with the documents and the documents control. But that's just the sort of thing that's not before you on 12B. More centrally, I think, Justice Jacobs, to your question, we do have controlling authority from the appellate courts of New York. And I'd cite in particular the General Investment Company case, which is discussed at some length at pages 19 and 20 of the report. That case, like this one.
I'm sorry, the case was?
General Investment Company versus Interborough Rapid Transit. It's the appellate division affirmed by the Court of Appeals. And they had there a no-action clause like ours. It refers only to the indenture. And there, the court holds that that clause does not bar the bondholder from bringing a claim that inheres in the bonds themselves, even though those bonds referred back to the indenture for the rights of the bondholder. So that case expresses the strict construction which courts in New York have placed on these clauses. The other
was that affirmance by a simple order, or is there anything?
I don't believe there's an opinion. The citation appears in Vice Chancellor Laster's report. It's 193 New York Sup 903. And then it's affirmed at 139 Northeast 216. I don't recall there being a substantive opinion on the affirmance. But there are other Court of Appeals decisions that the Vice Chancellor then cites in that passage of his report at 18 and 19. There's Enoch, there's Hibbs. They're both Court of Appeals decisions that rejected a challenge based on a no-action clause like the one we have here. The other thing to say is that this is just Section 7.06 of an indenture. We interpret it like any other section of the indenture, according to its plain words. That's the rule of Greenfield versus Phyllis, which is a recent Court of Appeals decision. The words here are plain. Think of it in this way. The indenture is drafted, I believe, in 04. As of 2004, there are many decisions in this court, in the courts of Delaware and in the courts of New York, in which the decisions come out different ways based on what's in the no-action clause. For example, in Mabon Nugent, which is decided by the Chancery Court in Delaware, the non-contractual claims survive because there's only a reference in that decision to the indenture. So the people who wrote this indenture knew they could insert the phrase that was there for Feldbaum, that was there for Lange, to get to that result, and they omitted to do so, even though in Section 13.01 of the same indenture, which is the non-recourse provision, they were careful to say there's no recourse based on the indenture and there's no recourse based on the securities. Let me cut ahead then.
So are no action clauses narrowly construed or not under New York law?
They're narrowly construed in this sense, Justice Ridgely. A no-action clause takes away from a litigant what the legislature has given him, a right of action. So courts will not do that unless the parties have expressly removed that right. And in New York, where parties expressly had done so by reference, express reference to the bonds as well as the indenture, even some of the early cases, as and they're cited in footnotes by Vice Chancellor Laster, would uphold the bar. But where there isn't this express reference, the court would not take away what otherwise is a right that the legislature has given to the party. And I did want to emphasize that because at this point the case would simply proceed in the Court of Chancery, you wouldn't have a final order construing this particular clause.
Well, you may not have a final order, but you would have a ruling of a matter of law by the highest court of this day, and that would operate as stare decisis. That wouldn't change when the order becomes final, would it? I mean, it would be the law of the case.
I think, Your Honor, it would be the law of the case, and I don't know whether it's possible for you to simply, on the recommendation of the report, to reverse in part the dismissal and remand, how much that matters for stare decisis purposes, because it would still be open to our colleagues to try to introduce extraneous evidence or argue that the agreement was ambiguous or something. In any event, we have all both cited a lot of law from Delaware on these clauses, and I don't recall this ever being.
Well, wouldn't it be the same level of stare decisis that general investment is with the affirmance by an order if we reverse by an order?
Well, I suppose, Your Honor, except that general investment is a decision of the appellate division in New York, so it does represent appellate authority in New York. And it is consistent with other court of appeals decisions that are cited in the footnotes that are similar to that. So there is authority that is fully supportive of the position that we've taken here.
I'd like to get back to your comments about the unusual posture, if you will. If I understand you, you're saying that given the report, as being the latest statement from the Court of Chancery as to what should be done on this motion to dismiss, that this court could simply let the case go forward just as it would do with a case that hadn't been appealed and not give any particular authority, if you will, to the report, but simply along the lines of the court granted re-argument and changed its mind, so now you're going forward.
I believe that's correct. In other words, the big picture is that the trial judge, the vice chancellor in this case, has said, there's enough here to go forward. Now, we're not at summary judgment yet. We're certainly not at trial yet. We haven't started discovery for 2 years. But lots of things may change in that case. And I think, given the amount of work that the chancellor did responding to the direction from this court, it would be an exercise of judicial efficiency and prudence to essentially adhere to his recommendation.
But if we were to be judicially inefficient, we could dismiss this appeal without an opinion and allow the case just to proceed to a final judgment. At least that's what I take from your response to Justice Berger's question.
But I think, Your Honor, if you dismissed the appeal, we'd be stuck with the one-page order that now the Vice Chancellor himself disagrees with.
So you're proposing that we affirm in part and reverse in part the original judgment based on his report.
Yes, Your Honor.
And to the extent we don't want to take a definitive position with regard to what the New York law is, and that can wait until the proceedings end and there's a final judgment and an appeal. That's your choice.
That's the suggestion.
And your opponent's position is the New York law is clear and that the original judgment should be affirmed.
He has said that many times, including a minute ago, but I frankly don't understand it because there isn't a single New York case, not one, that they've cited that is like this one. There's not one where none of these Walnut Place cases is a case where anybody would disagree about the reach of the no action clause. The litigant is bringing suit on the contract. The no action clause says you can't bring a suit on the contract. Everybody agrees, including Vice Chancellor Laster, who's knocked out two of my counts on that basis, and we've conceded as we must on that point. So there's nothing new in these new cases that would cause you to consider the law to be unsettled in New York. The reason that they didn't cite Victor and Cruden was Victor and Cruden dealt with the problem that we have, and those cases don't. So I think before we certify something to the Court of Appeals, there ought to be a real contest in New York law. Emmett, by the way, just in passing, this Emmett case, I don't think you got the full picture on that one. In that case, somebody's making a clever argument that the trustee has miscalculated how he's to apply interest between tranches of bonds. And just as happened in RBC with Chancellor Strine, the court says, wait a minute, you're really attacking interest here. So, and besides, in Emmett, the ruling in the case, they say, is that when you're attacking a provision under the indenture, then you're bound by a no-action clause that refers to the indenture. It doesn't, as Vice Chancellor Laster said at page 27 of his report, these cases don't shed light on the problem that we have here. By virtue or availing of, I probably can't add anything to all the grammar and textual analysis we put in the briefs, except nobody's reading of that phrase takes you to getting securities that don't appear in that section 7.06 into the text. Whereas the parties are careful to insert securities in lots of other places in the same document. I was scurrying to confirm, Justice Jacobs, I believe there was no certification in continental Illinois. I could be wrong about that, but I think that was another case where the court looked at the document and said, this document doesn't reach the kind of claim that they're talking about. And even though it was a New York document, there was no need to certify. That's what we contend that we have here. My colleague says that we're resting on words that don't appear in the document. Well, we're resting on words that are all over the document, just not in the right section, and that were written at a time when people who wrote these indentures had lots of models that contained this or the securities phrase that had been construed by various courts to bar everything. They could have selected that model, and they didn't. That's the meaningful thing for purposes of granting the plain meaning of the contract.
You're saying that it may be clunky, but it's still clear.
Yes, it's not a model of English grammar, and you know it's easy for lawyers after the fact to criticize how it could have been written better. But the legal test is what's the objective meaning that flows from these words. If Your Honors have no further questions, I'll. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and